Drake countered. "Whereas I was driven from my family by a treacherous enemy." Malthorn waved his hand dismissively. "You and I both know that is a lie. I agree that there are lies being told in this conversation, yes, and that one of us is a liar with no known equal."
"And so the king has promised you clemency if you will stay and fight,"
Malthorn said.
"Somehow you have even put yourself in charge of navy resources in your quest for personal glory. But remember this, Drake, at the end of the day it will be my plans, my fleet, and my tactics that carry the day. Rest assured that the king and all of Albion will know the truth as the story of this battle is written."
"I'm not interested in your boasting," Drake said. "I want to hear how you plan to use Dreadnought to help me defeat the Hrum."
"The first thing I will do is take command of the whole fleet. From this point you will obey my orders, as will all of the other captains and commanders."
"Funny, I was going to say the same thing."
Malthorn stared back with a poisonous look.
"You do not seriously suggest that I serve under your command. What kind of fool do you take me for?"
"Again, I was going to say the same thing," Drake said, letting a smile touch his lips. "But since neither of us is likely to take commands from the other, and since I know you will attempt to kill me once this fight is over if, God willing, we defeat the Death Cult, let me suggest this. You stay outside the range of the orbital fortresses. The Hrum will make a run, we will drive them off, and you will finish them as they retreat and regroup."
Malthorn said nothing, just stared.
Drake continued. "Let me remind you, Admiral, that the forts are under my command at the order of His Majesty King Bartholomew, and not even Dreadnought can slug it out with gun emplacements buried into the side of an asteroid. When the battle is won, I will withdraw and communicate directly with the Crown as I arrange to be reinstated into the Royal Navy. If you don't like that, you can argue with the King. Now, I believe this conversation is at an end. You have your duties, and I have mine."
Drake ended the call. For a long moment he stood trembling with barely suppressed rage, hating Malthorn with all of his heart. When he looked around, the others on the deck were staring at him. Tolvern's mouth hung open, and Cap was gaping as she rubbed her hand over her buzzed scalp. Nib Pim blinked, and Manx and Smythe shook their heads in what was either admiration or fear, or perhaps a little of both. He checked the status of his fleet and estimated he had 90 minutes before the battle recommenced. Drake went into the war room, sat down, folded his arms, and lowered his head to sleep.
Chapter 23. The next phase of the battle began in a promising way. Drake had feared that the remaining sloops of the Death Fleet would come through en masse. He didn't think he had enough forces between Fort Ellen and Fort William to keep them from breaking through. But the Hrum commander, perhaps not recognizing the huge advantage gained with St. George's destruction, split his force in two, with 10 ships to run at the gap and an equal number to come up over the southern polar region. This pole was poorly defended from orbit, but the surface was an icy sea, dotted with uninhabited islands. If the sloops broke through, they'd be exposed for an hour or more within the atmosphere, where they were poorly designed to travel, before they could reach inhabited landmasses. Drake sent a destroyer and 4 torpedo boats to chase them, should they break through. Meanwhile, he'd take his chances in the south for the opportunity to face a smaller fleet over the northern hemisphere. Drake spent a few minutes positioning his defensive cordon as the Hrum warships charged him. He filled the surrounding space with torpedoes and missiles. During the break in fighting, Blackbeard had pulled up warily to Fort William, prepared to be boarded, but in desperate need of the torpedoes and missiles that the fort commander was offering. The offer proved genuine, and now Barker had an embarrassing wealth of ordnance to fire, and was spending it with all the reserve of a drunk pirate in a whorehouse. The Hrum crashed into his defenses. Missiles and torpedoes ripped apart one sloop, and Fort Ellen's guns forced another to withdraw, its engines dead. Drake moved Churchill, supported by a destroyer, to catch 2 sloops threatening to break through, and the 4 opposing warships slugged it out with little effect for several minutes.
Meanwhile, Blackbeard and Vigilant stood against four more sloops, dancing through pulse cannon and absorbing serpentine bomblets, as they forced the sloops toward Fort William. In the south, three of the sloops had broken through, while the rest stood back to lend them fire support. Torpedo boats caught one of the sloops while it was still in the stratosphere and sent it crippled and burning to the icy sea below. The other two fled north, pursued by torpedo boats. Dreadnought arrived. She lumbered around from the dark side of the moon, leading several cruisers, corvettes, destroyers, and missile frigates. Final victory was close at hand. Drake waited for Malthorn to push into position to form a bulwark against which the faltering Death Fleet would be dashed. But to Drake's anger and dismay, Dreadnought continued forward. Her cannon came out, and missile and torpedo bays activated all along her side. She meant to enter the fray close to Albion. There was too much firepower at work already. It would only confuse the issue and make it easier for a sloop or two to break through. Drake sent an angry message. Malthorn did not reply.
"Sweet heavens," Tolvern whispered.
The viewscreen was split now, showing the green sloops of war on one side, still twisting and dancing to break through Albion's defenses. On the other, Dreadnought, the black, monstrous battleship, like something out of legend. She was firing the first broadside, a bellow of dragon fire, longer than the entire length of Blackbeard. But then warning lights flashed everywhere, and Jane's voice sounded her calm concern. Dreadnought was ignoring the Hume fleet and firing at Blackbeard. Malthorn's treachery hadn't caught Blackbeard by complete surprise. Drake had never supposed that the Admiral would ignore the Hume to attack him exclusively, but he had fully expected a torpedo or two, a side shot when Malthorn thought he could catch the renegade cruiser off guard. And so Blackbeard was already launching countermeasures and performing evasive maneuvers. Cannon fire raked Blackbeard along the stern as the ship fled. To evade the missiles, Drake ordered them behind Fort Ellen. Two missiles slammed into the unprepared fort, and a torpedo hit the gray rocky protuberance that formed the underside of the hollowed-out asteroid. The fort returned fire at Dreadnought, seemingly surprised, but responding with hostility at the unexpected assault.
"Bring her around," Drake said grimly. Into the calm he added, "Barker, full broadside, target Dreadnought's main battery."
"We can't fight Dreadnought," Tolvern said. "She'll eat us alive."
"We had better hope we're not alone then."
Fort Ellen's response had surprised him and given him hope. And as Blackbeard swung into action again, Rutherford came swooping in on HMS Vigilant, her guns blazing at the battleship. Potterman's destroyer swung around and fired a torpedo at Dreadnought, and all three of the pirate frigates joined a navy frigate in launching a barrage of missiles. Explosions tore along Dreadnought's side, her belly, and her upper decks. Many of the other ships, however, rushed to defend the Admiral's flagship. In an instant, the battlefield had descended into chaos. Cruisers shooting at cruisers, and firing on Hume sloops. Fort Ellen firing on Dreadnought while taking fire from Fort William. Dreadnought shooting at Fort Ellen, at Navy ships, at the Hume. And the sloops attacking anything and everything, even as they continued trying to break through. Debris and explosions filled the sky, with flaming ships knocked into space or spiraling from orbit. Orient Tiger pulled away, as if Katerina had decided to flee. Drake couldn't blame her. She had never agreed to battle the might of the Royal Navy. He was only surprised that the three pirate frigates had fought as long as they had.
"Captain!" Smythe cried. "The sloops are breaking through!"
The Hume fleet had been weakening, but Malthorn's eagerness to punish Drake had breathed new life into their assault. Many of the sloops were destroyed, knocked out of the battle, or crippled and bleeding plasma. But a small, determined knot kept trying to force its way through. Three of them charged Fort William, drawing its fire. The last two squirmed through the gap. They dropped into the atmosphere. Drake's heart leaped.
"Follow them!"
Blackbeard dove into the atmosphere. Jane warned of pending explosions as Dreadnought chased Blackbeard down with a final missile barrage. but by the time Drake's pilots had them below 100,000 feet, they'd shaken off the missiles. And now Orient Tiger appeared a few hundred yards off starboard, following Blackbeard down. Drake hailed Katerina, voice only. The sloops were about 150 miles ahead of him, and almost to the surface.
"It looked like you were going to run," he said.
"I thought about it, believe me," Katerina said. "But if I run now, how can I be sure I'll get my payoff? Also, I've grown fond of you lot, would hate to see you killed down here. So what's the plan?"
"Do we need a plan?" Drake asked. "Get close enough and blast them. That's about as much as I've got."
"Good enough. For Albion and the King, or whatever rubbish I'm supposed to say here. See you on the other side."
They were above Britain, flying east at 80,000 feet over the Welsh Mountains, a massive snow-capped range that bisected the continent. It was dawn, and the sun glared from across the fertile York Plain, but Blackbeard's instruments could stare right through a star and see what was hiding on the other side, and Smythe got it filtered out and the enemy back on visual. The two sloops of war were flying in a line. The rear Hroom warship was smoking from a fire on the rear deck. Tolvern, studying her console, said the fire looked terminal. But how soon? At these supersonic speeds, they were only 70 minutes from the outer villages, towns, and ring roads of the Yorktown metropolis. Drake waited until they were within 100 miles of the enemy before he ordered missiles. Blackbeard had better capabilities in the atmosphere than a Hroom sloop, but her ordnance was calibrated for fighting in the void, not in an atmosphere. Indeed, the missiles struggled to lock on the sloops, and rudimentary countermeasures from the enemy sent them corkscrewing to the surface, where they hit the rolling green hills and detonated. He kept closing. Now they were over the plains, mixed pasture and mile after mile of golden wheat ready for the harvest. At 20 miles, he opened with his deck guns. This had little effect at first, but he kept probing as they drew closer, and Orient Tiger on his flank soon scored the first hits. Both ships kept pounding away, opening a gaping hole in the rear shields of the wounded enemy sloop. Suddenly she dove toward the ground.
"Captain!" Tolvern warned. "The fissiles!"
Dear God, no. The sloop was loaded with atomic warheads. If it detonated while they were flying over... Drake shouted a command across to Katerina, and then Blackbeard and Orient Tiger veered sharply away. The sloop hit the ground and exploded. A giant mushroom cloud rose into the sky. The cruiser and the frigate were racing away from the explosion and managed to evade the blast wave.
"Jane," Drake said to the computer, "how big was that blast?"
"Estimating 22 megatons.
There was silence on the bridge. Finally, Cap said,
"What the devil does that mean? That's bloody huge, right?"
"Hundreds of square miles in diameter, it would seem," Drake said.
Even in the lightly populated farmland of the York Plain, that blast must have vaporized several villages and estates and killed thousands of people. If the other sloop reached the dense settlements along the St. Lawrence River with that kind of payload, where a fifth of Albion's population lived, the atomic bombs within its belly would put 100 million lives at risk. Evading the bomb blast had left them far behind the final sloop, which had continued east toward the St. Lawrence and Yorktown. Blackbeard and Orient Tiger corrected course and raced in pursuit. Drake tried again with the missiles, but with no success. Someone in orbit fired down a few shots of their own, and one of these hit the sloop, doing moderate damage. But the three-way fight was still raging up above, and Drake had little fire support. They were soon flying over more settled regions. The Hroom ship detoured slightly and came over the top of Adelaide, a provincial capital of 60 or 80,000 along the shores of Loch Foyle. Drake caught his breath, knowing there was only one reason the sloop would make a detour. He was still too far out to use his cannon. The sloop dropped a warhead. There was silence on the bridge as it fell. A flash and a second mushroom cloud. It was a fraction the size of the massive explosion over the plains, but big enough when dropped in the middle of a small city.
"Jane," Drake said.
His voice sounded hollow.
"Estimate the yield."
"Estimating
20 kilotons.
Or roughly 1,000th the size of the explosion caused by the detonating Hroom sloop. The warship must be stuffed with atomic warheads. Now he understood why some of the sloops hadn't used their serpentines. They didn't have space for extra ordnance. There must be defender ships and atomic attack ships. Malthorn's treachery had allowed two of the latter to slip through. The detour to vaporize Adelaide had allowed Blackbeard and Orient Tiger to close some of the distance to the enemy ship, and they were still 20 miles from the outskirts of Yorktown when the sloop fell within range of their guns. Drake ordered all available firepower brought to bear, and everything from cannon to torpedoes and missiles flew at the enemy ship. Its shields took hits, and it began to smoke. There was no chatter on Drake's deck, no side conversations, only anxious, highly focused orders and responses. The gunnery was furiously working to bring that ship down, while Nib, Pim, and Cap took advantage of every enemy maneuver to close the distance a few more yards and bring the sloop further into the range of Blackbeard's guns. Off starboard, Orient Tiger matched their pace. Another bomb dropped as the sloop passed over Shelby, then a third at Hawes Bay. These two towns on the outskirts of Yorktown went up in clouds of fire and ash. Drake could only imagine the panic on the densely populated banks of the St. Lawrence as old air raid sirens went off. An alien assault had always been a hypothetical possibility, but the Hroom Empire had never once penetrated Albion's defenses to attack the surface. Already, 3 cities had been annihilated, and dozens, even hundreds more, faced the same fate if Drake couldn't destroy the enemy ship in time.
"She's going down!" Tolvern shouted.
Yes, it was true. The Hroom sloop was on fire, its engines sputtering, spilling plasma that tumbled in great globules 50,000 feet to ignite towns and forests in raging infernos. All 3 ships were at 50,000 feet, but the sloop was losing altitude in a hurry. Only not fast enough. Someone tracked the ship's trajectory and where it would come down. The result was disaster. The blue, curving ribbon of the St. Lawrence lay dead ahead. On its banks and beyond stretched the city of Yorktown. 5 million people. The green, bucolic west bank of the city was already visible from here. The palace, the king's gardens, and the royal forest. A spire of stone rose at the edge of the palace, York Tower, the tallest building on the west bank of the river. It was the very place Drake's parents had been held prisoner. On the east bank were the Kingdom Tower skyscrapers in the heart of the city. Near that lay the Houses of Parliament, the offices of the Royal Exchequer, the headquarters of the Bank of Albion, the fleet headquarters of the Royal Navy, and practically every other symbol of royal and government power. Both human ships were firing constantly, launching every conceivable weapon in an attempt to bring down the Hroom ship. Plenty of shots were hitting, and the whole back end of the sloop was breaking apart. But at these speeds, not fast enough. The sloop had no control, could only fall as it continued its forward momentum. It was at 5,000 feet, then 2,000, and then Drake had no choice but to pull up. Blackbeard and Orient Tiger climbed away. The sloop had long overshot the city center, and was nearly 6 miles east and several miles south of the heart of Yorktown when it hit. It didn't matter, not really, not with that kind of payload. A flash, a blackened viewscreen, and a rumble that caught Blackbeard and tossed it like a rowboat on an angry sea. When the viewscreen cleared again, a massive mushroom cloud was rising above the city, together with a rolling shockwave that obliterated the land for miles around. The whole of Yorktown was caught in the explosion. The king, the palace, parliament, every major building of the Albion government, gone in an instant.
Chapter 24. Drake led Blackbeard and Orient Tiger back into orbit to discover one battle won and the other lost. The last of the Hroom suicide ships had been defeated.
Two sloops had broken past and into the atmosphere, but they'd been heavily damaged already and were hunted down by a torpedo boat and Potterman's destroyer and finished off. The human ships chasing the sloops that had entered the atmosphere in the southern hemisphere had destroyed those enemies as well, before they could reach inhabited land. Nothing remained of the suicidal fleets. The cult of the Hrum god of death, Liam Kar, had been vanquished. This victory had come at a terrible cost. Yorktown was destroyed, and several million people presumed dead. The capital city, the very heart of Albion, was no more. The king himself must have been killed in the initial blast. Meanwhile, Dreadnought had taken a terrible beating, but had in turn mauled Fort Ellen into submission, cowed Fort William and the other orbital forts into joining him, and destroyed several mutinying vessels. Vigilant Pussycat, Outlaw, and several Navy destroyers, corvettes, frigates, and torpedo boats continued the struggle long enough to allow Blackbeard and Orient Tiger to escape Albion's gravity well. And then this battered flotilla of pirates and Royal Navy ships fled toward outer space. For the next hour, Malthorn gave chase with Dreadnought and several cruisers and corvettes, but he seemed to have darker plans in store. Returning to Albion's orbit, he brought his marines out of stasis and sent them to the surface to take command of the Royal Marine bases. By the time Blackbeard and the others reached the nearest jump point a day later, Malthorn had declared himself the sole head of the Admiralty, elevated Colonel Fitzgibbons to Major General of the Royal Marines, and placed the planet under martial law. Some of the dukes, earls, and other aristocrats voiced opposition, but the outcry was muted. And then Drake brought his fleet through the jump point, and they lost the thread of news for a stretch. It was 3 weeks after the battle when Tolvern once again stood on the surface of a planet. After the escape from York Tower, she hadn't expected to have her feet on solid ground again so soon. Today she relaxed in a pleasant little inn, enjoying the warmth and earthy smell of a peat fire on the hearth. Rain pattered on the roof and streaked the windows. She nursed a mug of dark beer and waited for her meal to arrive. At the moment she was the only one of Blackbeard's crew in the tavern, and the others in the room, fishermen, shepherds, and peat diggers, watched her curiously. They'd planted themselves in Aberdeen. It was the fourth largest town on Saxony, but it was more like an overgrown village, not much larger than the provincial towns of her home island of Auckland. Only 20 million people lived on the cold, damp world of Saxony, the majority near the equator, where they scratched a living on the rainy moors, the heath-covered plains, and the marginal farmlands stretching in a belt of several million square miles in what they called the Temperate Zone. She supposed it was temperate, if by that you meant it didn't snow much. Of course, it was currently the middle of summer, and just walking from her quarters to the tavern had left her soaked with a chilling rain. Saxony's climate had apparently been warmer during the initial years of settlement, when the planet had seemed even more promising to the Anglosphere refugees from Earth than Albion itself. But that had been deceptive. Unbeknownst to the early settlers, Saxony had been enjoying an interglacial period in an ice age, and the ice sheets had already started to advance when humans arrived. Several hundred years later, ice entombed the northern and southern latitudes, leaving only a thin, habitable region near the equator. Drake pushed open the door. He kicked water from his boots and took off his hat and jacket to shake them dry. Tolvern had wondered if he would come in wearing a Navy uniform, as he'd just emerged from a meeting with Captain Rutherford at headquarters. But he still wore the tan canvas vest with the loops and brass buttons that she'd given him. He must have caught her appraising him as he approached.
"I would wear my old uniform, but I have been told I look good in this thing."
"By Katerina?"
"By you."
Tolvern felt herself blushing.
"Oh, yeah."
He gave her a friendly smile that set her at ease.
"Others have said so, too. Apparently I cut quite a figure."
"Aye, that you do, love,"
the barmaid said, approaching with a tankard of the dark beer that was the only thing on tap. She smiled at the captain coquettishly and set the beer in front of him. The barmaid was an attractive young woman with red hair and freckles, who had been flirting with every officer in the fleet, men, women, and Froome alike.
"Thank you, miss," Drake said, somewhat formally.
The barmaid winked and returned to the kitchen.
"I understand that we're enlisted in the Navy again," Tolvern said. "Is that the gist of it, sir?"
"Yes, I suppose we are. Those who are up for it, anyway."
"What about Katerina Vargas?" Tolvern said. "You aren't tempted to follow her?"
She kept her tone careful, neutral, not wanting to suggest anything one way or the other.
"A little bit, yes. Katerina has a vision, and I admit that I find it enticing."
"A vision of piracy?"
"A vision. We'll leave it at that."
Drake took a long drink of his beer. "But if you're asking if we're lovers, the answer is no, not anymore. I won't follow her, and she won't follow me. How could we? It would be a fleet of two, and without a clear leader. That is untenable. So I'm afraid we're finished."
Tolvern didn't allow herself to hope. Since that awkward moment when she had spotted the two of them together, she'd always suspected Katerina Vargas and the captain would part ways sooner or later, and Tolvern was no longer afraid to admit to herself that she would happily take Katerina's place and do so permanently. But Drake, as much as he seemed to value her friendship, would never offer such a thing, that she was sure.
"Besides," Drake continued, "that is more than enough excitement right here, fighting Malthorn and freeing Albion for one. Then there is the matter of what General Mos Driz and the Froome Empire will do with the sugar antidote. Will they keep fighting us? Or are they embroiled in their own civil war with the Death Cult? And will we make common cause against Apex?"
At the moment, Apex and the Froome were too much to worry about. It was Malthorn that held Tolvern's attention, and how to muster the forces to defeat him.
"So Katerina is leaving for good?" she asked. "There's nothing you can promise to keep Orient Tiger in the fight?"
"Apparently not. Katerina is only in orbit until we can scrape up a bounty from this bleak rock. Then she will be gone."
"But her sister Isabel is staying."
He sighed. "Assuming we can pay her debts, of course. With what the king promised her, it might take a while."
Drake spent a few minutes laying out the situation as it stood. Malthorn had not declared himself king, but it was assumed that this was only a matter of forming a new parliament and having the House of Lords beg him to take the crown. Malthorn would make a great show of reluctance, then take it. To counter this move, Rutherford had sent a message to his uncle, the Duke of West Mercia, offering him the crown. The Duke had been eighth in line to the throne before the attack, and a respected figure both on Albion and in the colonies. He was said to be mulling the offer, but the planet of Mercia was currently neutral in the struggle. Even with Mercia's aid, the anti-Malthorn forces would be outnumbered and outgunned. Without Mercia, they would be doomed. Meanwhile, Drake and Rutherford were cobbling together a fleet to form the heart of the rebellion. Or rather, the Loyalists, as Drake called them. They'd augmented their fleet with two disabled warships captured in the Griffin Shoals, Richmond and Calypso, cruisers left drifting and crippled after battling a Froome fleet. The two ships were currently undergoing repairs in Saxony's orbit. Most of the rest of Drake's forces were also damaged, and some had been sent to San Pablo for repair as skilled manpower was in short supply on Saxony. Hubert Rodriguez, who had worked on Blackbeard after her fights with Vigilant and Captain Kidd, was overseeing the work. As soon as Richmond was repaired, Catherine Cates would be given command. She'd been named the third-ranking officer in Drake's fleet, which surprised Tolvern. How old was Cates, 28? Potterman, older and steadier, but with his best years behind him, would take command of Calypso.
"We're pretty thin on leadership," Tolvern said. "Is there any hope?"
"I certainly think so. Of course, I would like our chances better if we had 100,000 marines to guard this planet, not a ragtag militia. And if I didn't think Malthorn would do to Mercia what he did to San Pablo."
"Surely not," she said, horrified. "Dropping atomic weapons on Froome is one thing, but Albion citizens?"
"He as good as destroyed Yorktown when he let those sloops through. If he had attacked the aliens instead of Blackbeard,
5 million Albionish would still be alive. Tolvern fell silent, because of course he was right, although such a monstrous thing could scarcely be imagined. She finished her tankard and waved to the barmaid for another, not because she needed any more of the strong beer, but because she didn't know what else to say.
"You have a choice, you know," Drake added. "Katerina likes you. She would happily give you a position on her bridge."
"Working with pirates like that fellow with a Gatling gun for an arm? No thanks."
"You already work with pirates."
Drake lifted his drink in a mock toast.
"Cheers to that, me hearty."
Tolvern laughed. "If it's all the same, I'll stay with you."
"I never thanked you properly for rescuing my parents. I want to do that now. Thank you, from the bottom of my heart."
"I was just... it was only my duty, sir."
"And I wanted to tell you how worried I was when I saw Paradis knocked out of position. As soon as the first away pod missed the hook, I could scarcely breathe. I was sure you were going down after it. I thought I'd lost you. Did you know, did you see that you might miss the transfer?"
"I did, and I was terrified," she admitted.
"So was I." Drake put a hand on her arm, and her heart skipped.
"I was more relieved than you know, Jess."
"Me too."
It was a weak response, but she found herself tongue-tied. They stared at each other, and she thought he might say something else. But then Drake cleared his throat.
"Anyway, what do you know of HMS Philistine?"
"Huh? Potterman's destroyer? Well, I suppose that once she's patched up again, she'll... wait. Why are you asking?"
"Potterman will be taking command of Calypso. That leaves an opening at the helm of his destroyer. As you said, we're thin on leadership."
"But I don't want to leave Ajax. I mean Blackbeard," she corrected.
She'd already begun to think of herself as a commander in the Royal Navy again, on the bridge of a Punisher-class cruiser.
"This is a promotion," Drake said, smiling. "You know that, right? Rank of captain. With all the free Saxony beer and haggis you can buy with the salary that entails."
"I want to be with you, by your side."
"I am pretty young."
"So is Catherine Cates, and we've given her a heavy cruiser. Surely you can manage a wee destroyer and its crew of 26.
Again he was smiling, his tone light and teasing, but she knew he was serious, and that this wasn't an offer so much as a command.
"Of course I will do it if that's what you want."
"I will miss you on my bridge, but yes. It's more than what I want, it's what I need."
"Captain Tolvern," she said, trying it out. "That does have a ring to it. Does this mean you're now Admiral Drake?"
He chuckled.
"No, just Captain. I will not choose for myself any title that hasn't been granted by my superiors. But perhaps if the Duke of West Mercia accepts the crown..."
He finished his beer and shrugged.
"We will see."
The door opened, and a young woman entered. She had short blonde hair, a bright, intelligent expression, and a military bearing. She handed her cloak to the barmaid and approached their table.
"Ah, here's Cates now," Drake said.
"May I join you two?"
"Please," Tolvern said.
"Thank you."
Cates eyed Drake briefly before turning back to Tolvern. "The rest will be here shortly, but I thought I'd introduce myself before Rutherford arrives. He's a little stiff, you know, and it will be all formal once he arrives. My name is Catherine Cates." Cates had a West Canadian accent, not so different from Tolvern's own, and that set her at ease. A young woman of good breeding, but without an impossibly arid upper-class accent and all that implied. She looked warm and friendly. Tolvern found herself instinctively liking the woman.
"I am Jess Tolvern, second in command on Blackbeard."
The women exchanged a firm handshake.
"Nice to make your acquaintance."
"I know all about you. When they said I'd be sent to Richmond, I assumed I'd be your commander and was pretty excited. I had no idea they meant to make me captain."
"It could have gone that way," Drake said. "Rutherford and I certainly discussed the possibility."
"Please, no," Tolvern said. "That would have been far too much responsibility for my first command."
"That's exactly what I said," Kate said with a laugh.
Rutherford came in shortly together with Potterman, the older man's arm in a cast and sling from an injury taken in the battle. Isabel Vargas joined them after the second round, adding a rougher edge to the company. By the time the barmaid brought out bowls of mutton stew and hunks of rye bread for supper, the workers had all left, and the tavern was rapidly filling up with officers. Cap came, after drinking hard with the enlisted types in one of the alehouses in town, suddenly doing booming business. She coaxed the barmaid into teaching them one of the local drinking songs, and dragged Tolvern up to dance with her. Cap winked and flirted with the younger officers, taunting them until they joined the song and dance. The barmaid produced a penny whistle, which added accompaniment. Soon Cap and Tolvern had half the room dancing. Even Drake and Rutherford, while they were not dancing, lent their strong baritones to the song. By now Tolvern was more than a little drunk. The room was warm and filled with food, drink, and good cheer. Several light years away, Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malthorn was plotting their destruction. But for tonight, those troubles seemed a universe away.
This is the end of Dreadnought, Book 3 of the Starship Blackbeard series. The story continues now with Book 4 of the Starship Blackbeard series, Rebellion of Stars.
Chapter 1. Pez Rickon never intended to become a rebel chief, only to stay free in the bush. Years before his escape, at the age of 10, he'd been taken as a slave after his home world fell to Albion. Slavers arrived soon after the surrender of the planet, slaughtering resistors and forcing sugar on millions. The young Hroom took his first spoonful of sugar from the shaking hand of his mother, while a human with a gun looked on. Within 2 days, Pez Rickon could think of nothing else but securing his next dose. They shipped him on a packed, stinking slave galleon to the Malthorn Estates on Hot Barsa. 8 weeks in transit, hundreds died en route. The healthy and ill alike were put to work. More died. Pez Rickon was a willing laborer from the beginning. He never complained, never shirked his duties, even when the work stretched to 16 hours a day during the harvest, with his only relief being his sugar rations. He always ate his ration down at once, sank into a swoon, and roused himself at the touch of a whip on his shoulders. Then it was back to work. Over the years, he grew unusually tall and strong for one who'd been ravaged by addiction since his youth, and was frequently put into the crews performing the most back-breaking work of the plantation. There was a lot of it. The humans rarely used machinery when sheer brute slave labor would do. When Pez Rickon was about 20, he was sent deep into the jungle with several dozen other slaves and their handlers to clear new cane fields. A strange lowland illness swept over the company shortly after they arrived. As the Hroom fell sick and began to die, the humans fled the pestilent land, abandoning them. Pez Rickon awoke one day from the illness, dehydrated, hungry, and desperate for sugar. He staggered out of his tent to find the dead everywhere. Bugs the size of his forearm chewed their faces, or gnawed off limbs to cart into the brush. No living room, no humans to be seen, and no sugar. Rain had battered down the tent holding the supplies and washed them away. Growing more desperate by the hour, Pez Rickon staggered through the red jungle of ferns and vines, heading in the general direction of the plantations. He drank from muddy streams and puddles, and ate small creatures to keep up his strength. Sugar. He must have it.
find his masters, and beg for relief. Yes, he was happy to return to slavery. Just give him sugar. Somehow he kept going for day after day. But as the days passed, it felt as though a cloud were lifting from his mind. He still needed to get back, but now began to give thought to other considerations. He picked the parasites from his body. He covered his scratches and gashes with leaves to keep his flesh from rotting. He was more cautious about the water he drank. He grew wary of predators. Finally, nearly 2 months after he'd been abandoned, he staggered out of the jungle, onto the edge of a recently harvested cane field. The cut stalks seemed to stretch for miles. A sickly sweet smell hung in the air. It inspired the old craving, but it was faded, like a dull ache from an old injury, never fully healed.
"You! What are you doing here?"
a voice said to him in Hroom. He turned to see an overseer with a whip and a stun gun. A free Hroom, not a slave, yet with the pale pink skin of an eater. Pez Rikken looked down at his own bare arms, to see them mottled red through the pink. The mark of a sugar eater was fading from his skin. The overseer cursed.
"You are one of those feral bush people, aren't you?"
His hand touched his stun gun.
"No, I..."
Pez Rikken swallowed.
"I was abandoned in the jungle. I came back."
The large eyes narrowed.
"When did you last eat?" "Whatever and whenever I could scavenge. This morning I..." "Sugar, you fool. When did you last eat?" "Weeks ago. I don't know."
The overseer reached into a side pocket of his trousers. He fished out a vial of sugar.
"Here, take this. You'll soon feel better."
Revulsion mixed with craving as the overseer stepped toward him. They were alone, the two of them. Pez Rikken could easily flee into the jungle, leave all of this behind. Never work for the cursed humans again, producing the very substance that kept his body enslaved. Pez Rikken reached for the sugar, as if someone had seized control of his limbs. But when his hand closed around the vial, it tightened and kept squeezing. The vial broke, spilling sugar all over the overseer's hand.
"Are you mad?"
the overseer shouted. Pez Rikken wiped his hand on his damp, tattered clothing, even as the overseer lapped the bits of sugar from his own palm. Then the overseer reached for his stun gun. Pez Rikken grabbed his wrist. The abandoned slave had been living in the bush, subsisting on whatever meager food the jungle gave up. He should have been no match for the overseer. But the bit of sugar seemed to be taking effect. The overseer's eyes widened, and his grip went slack. Pez Rikken wrestled the stun gun free and turned it on its owner. He sent a jolt of electricity through the overseer, who collapsed to the ground, shaking and convulsing. A white rage had come over the slave, and he kept the weapon pressed against his enemy's flesh. When he drew back a few seconds later, the overseer was dead. Pez Rikken fled into the jungle. For the next year, he staged solo raids on the edge of the sugar plantations, taking food, killing an occasional overseer or human, and burning a sugar mill. Then he met up with another marooned former slave by the name of Epa Pym, and they began to work together. She would eventually become his mate. Others joined them. They became dozens. The humans mounted expeditions with their security forces, but could never catch Pez Rikken and his small band. For 5 years, they fought a low-level bush war, always one step ahead of the enemy. And then their luck ran out. One of Pez Rikken's fighters was captured, and apparently she gave up the location of the Free Hroom base under torture, because the enemy was soon on them.
The first warning was the sound of a helicopter buzzing over the free village, and then firebombs rained from the sky. In came humans wearing armored cool suits and leading an army of several hundred armed sugar slaves. They rampaged into the bush village, slaughtering indiscriminately, burning people alive in their homes. Pez Rickon hadn't expected that. Lord Malthorn's forces preferred to take rebels and force-feed them sugar. But word had reached the swamps and jungles that Malthorn was embroiled in a civil war on Albion, and it seemed that he'd decided on harsher measures. Pez Rickon organized a defense on the western edge of the village, at the site of a weapons cache, and where the trees growing along a muddy creek provided shelter. The enemy ignored him at first, concentrating on destroying the village. They set one stilt home after another on fire until the center of the village was a roaring inferno, and the screams of the dying filled the air. Pez Rickon lost soldiers to the fire as they ran back to try to rescue their mates and children. But others came pouring out of the flames, and he armed them as they arrived. Soon he had a few dozen survivors, and the enemy took note of them at last. A helicopter fired down on them, but the free room took to the creek to hide until it passed. A silver-suited human marine came forward from the village, leading his pale-skinned slaves. Pez Rickon organized a spirited defense to drive them back. At the same time, one of his fighters loaded a rocket into a shoulder launcher and fired it at the helicopter. The helicopter jammed it somehow, and the rocket went off course. But it served its purpose, forcing the craft to retreat over the jungle and away from the village. These two small victories heartened the rebels. Pez Rickon's lieutenant and mate, Epa Pym, began to organize a counterattack to retake the village.
"No," Pez Rickon told her. "The village is lost."
"There are still people alive in there."
"I know that."
He tried to keep the shaking from his voice.
"I can hear their dying screams, but there are too many enemies, and that helicopter will be back. We have to get to cover before it does."
Indeed, he could hear the thumping again already. From the village came renewed gunfire. There was nothing left to set ablaze, and the humans were reorganizing the slaves to push against the last holdouts by the creek. Pez Rickon hesitated a moment longer, staring toward the mass of flames, willing any survivors to come to him. Now, hurry before it was too late. But there was no one, only the screaming. He lifted his hand.
"Go!"
Chapter 2. For the first day, Pez Rickon thought they'd made good their escape as they traveled single file through the dense forest. His survivors spoke in low, hooting voices, the respectful tone of the grieving. Every so often the grief became too much, and someone let out a high, keening cry to the gods. How could they be so cruel? They were 43 in number when they set out, 38 adults and adolescents, and 5 children. 2 adults died of their wounds within the first few hours, and a child died shortly thereafter. A second child, his parents and siblings all killed in the village, threw himself into a crocodile-infested river as the others were searching for a way to safely cross. One of the beasts quickly grabbed him in its beak and dragged him under. Pez Rickon couldn't get the child's blank stare out of his mind, the way he'd ignored the shouts to stay back from the riverbank, how he'd spread his arms wide as he waded in, as if in prayer to the god of death.
"So many dead,"
he told his mate after they'd reached the forest edge late that afternoon, where they waited for a safe moment to cross the open plain.
"Why so many children, so many elderly? I told people, I warned them. Send your loved ones into the bush. Don't keep them with the fighters. They are a target. We cannot protect them."
"When can we cross?"
"Soon."
The entire company had come to a halt in the shadow of a ruined stone temple on the forest's edge. it was defensible against both the dangers of the jungle and the humans who were searching for them. He listened for a helicopter, but heard nothing.
"Should be safe enough to take a look."
Epa Pym gave instructions to the camp, and then tossed her head at Pezrikin, and the pair left the others and began to climb the temple's crumbling, vine-choked steps.
"Life is always uncertain," she told him. "We all knew there was a risk. Some chose to accept it, to live with what fate and the gods chose for them."
"And where are they now?" he asked. "Burned alive, enslaved to sugar if they're lucky. Tell me, do you think they'd have been more careful about controlling their fertility had they known?"
Epa Pym's face hardened.
"Must you be so callous?"
A hoot came out of his mouth before he could stop it. Her face hardened still further. She tromped her way up the steps, with Pezrikin following, wanting to press her, but knowing it would only make her angrier. They reached the top of the temple and pushed through the brush to the edge of a platform. The sun was a dying red ball on the horizon, staining the vast plain ahead of them in blood. A jagged mountain range sawed at the sky, some 30 or 40 miles to the north. The plain itself was flat, but for the hundreds of small hillocks rising from the tall, knife-bladed grass. Giant leathery birds circled overhead. They were large enough to carry off an unwary hroomling.
"Derisive laughter,"
Epa Pym said, dragging him from his thoughts.
"That's all you could manage?"
"No, love," he said. "That was an ironic, bitter hoot. It was not derisive. The enemy is not fate. It's not the whims of the gods. The enemy is the human race. They're the ones who killed those people, not me. So don't call me callous. I was anything but. I was soft, is what I was. I should have forced the same conditions on the army as I..."
He broke off, recognizing his mistake too late.
"As you what?"
she asked coldly.
"As you forced upon your mate, you mean?"
"I didn't force," he said defensively, glad that the rest of the room were below, on the jungle floor.
He was their chief, and couldn't be seen arguing with his mate.
"You refused to release your seed when we copulated," she said.
"We discussed the matter at great length," he said. "It was not the time."
"We never discussed. You informed me."
"Are you telling me you have regrets?" he asked. "With everything you know, you wish I'd released my seed? That we'd had offspring when they attacked the village?"
Epa Pym looked off into the distance. He couldn't believe that she was even considering the question. Their hroomlings would be dead now, murdered by the humans, along with all the others trapped in the village. Pezrikin followed her gaze. It was a vast, intimidating stretch of open land. They wouldn't cross in a night, or even two. It would be several days exposed to the human helicopters. But they had to get across. There was jungle and swampland on the other side, deep bush where the humans would never enter. But how would he cross? Perhaps shelter could be found on those hills that dotted the plain. No, not hills. They were buildings, he realized. Temples, shrines, rail stations, and palaces. Hot Barsa had once been one of the most prosperous and populous planets in the Hroom Empire. Before the sugar. Before the endless cycles of war, truce, and more war. He thought about the villages where he'd spent the last several years, a few huts on stilts, deep in the wilderness. Any dry ground divided into tiny vegetable plots that were farmed for a few seasons until the soil was exhausted. Simple homes for a simple people. But before him was the evidence of a different past, when Hroom were masters of this world.
"Humans did this,"
his mate said.
She must have been thinking the same thing.
They brought our civilization to its knees.
There's still a Hrum Empire.
At war with the humans again,
she pointed out.
How many planets will Albion devour this time? The Death Fleet failed, but not before inflicting a wound. Albion will be enraged. They will exact their vengeance.
They'd only heard about the Death Fleet long after its defeat. Several weeks after the battle, the so-called Jungle Telegraph brought the news deep into the wilderness, passing from sugar slaves to escaped slaves in the bush. A cult to the death god, Liam Kar, had attempted the atomic destruction of Albion. The humans had stopped all but one ship before it could reach its destination. That one had destroyed the capital city of Yorktown. But most of Albion was unscathed. Epa Pym studied him.
Do you still think an accommodation can be found?
I never did, he reminded her. I only thought that widespread revolt would force the humans to stand down. But no peace is impossible between our two species. Only a truce.
Even truce is accommodation.
He thought about the burning village.
Force is what humans understand, and violence.
What about the Death Fleet? She asked. Had you known, would you have prayed to Liam Kar for its success?
Pez Rickon turned this question over. To kill humans was one thing, but to wish for the destruction of an entire planet was another entirely. And yet, looking out over the red plain ahead of him, with its ruins, wasn't he witnessing the same thing, but done to his own people? An entire planet, its people dead, enslaved, or surviving in scattered enclaves. The evidence was in front of him.
Yes, he said. If it would have ended the war, I would have exterminated the humans.
They almost crossed the plain undetected. Another few hours, and they'd have been to the thick jungle on the other side. There were free Hrum settlements in those swamps and forests, and the wilderness stretched all the way to the mountain range, where it was said there were secret passageways to carry one through to the other side, ancient rail tunnels that cut straight through the heart of the mountains. Dawn set the horizon on fire, and the mountains ahead looked like the mist-shrouded spine of some immense beast. 8 more miles, perhaps 10, and they'd be through the grasslands. Pez Rickon knew he should look for shelter, but the protective forest was so close that he pressed on over the worried noises of his exhausted people. Epa Pym stared at him, a hum in the back of her throat, indicating uncertainty. He didn't meet her gaze.
"Onward," he urged. "We are close now. We..."
He stopped. A distant buzz reached his ears. At first he thought he was mistaken, that it was just a scissor bee circling overhead and looking for an unwary victim from which to bite off a chunk of flesh. But the buzzing soon changed into the familiar lethal thumping.
"There!"
someone yelled. Pez Rickon turned to see a black shape to the southeast, not a scissor bee or a stab hawk, but a human helicopter swooping toward them.
"Everyone down!" he yelled.
More than 40 Hrum threw themselves to the ground. The grass was sharp and spiky here, and nearly knee-high. They'd have been concealed from the ground. Pouncers could lie in wait in grass this high until you were nearly upon them, then fly out with a terrible shriek and drag away the unwary. But Pez Rickon could only hope that the helicopter didn't approach too closely, or they'd be spotted from above. The sound grew louder. A shadow passed over, the monstrous roar of a propeller churning the air directly above, and Pez Rickon's body went limp, some ancient Hrum instinct for playing dead. And then it was past, and he drew in a deep breath. But before he could relax, the sound changed. The helicopter was banking around.
We've been spotted,
Epa Pym cried. Froom staggered to their feet and scattered. Pez Rickon roared for them to stop, and most did. A few, civilians from the village, ignored his command and waded through the grass, trying to flee. The rest he organized as best he could. Froom males and females put assault rifles to their shoulders as the human craft reappeared. Pez Rickon ordered them to shoot. Gunfire lashed at the sky and forced the helicopter to swerve. A snout-like cannon on its nose fired as it did so. Bullets chewed up the ground. Froom cried out and fell. The helicopter circled around for another attack. Pez Rickon led about a dozen Froom to a flanking point where they crouched in the grass, while Epa Pym kept the main body massed, their guns facing forward to take the enemy head-on. It roared toward them. Gunfire blasted at it from the front and side. Pez Rickon expected the cannon. Instead, light flared on the helicopter's underbelly. A missile raced toward the main group of Froom. There was a flash of light, and then a hammer blow struck Pez Rickon in the chest and threw him to the ground. He got up, ears ringing. The helicopter was hovering almost directly ahead of him. Now its cannon had started up again and was pouring fire on the site of the missile blast. The grass caught fire. Pez Rickon lifted his rifle and fired at the helicopter. Other Froom were rising around him, and they too began to shoot. Bullets pinged off the side of the helicopter. Too late, it seemed to notice this small but determined knot of resistors and began to swing around. But it was listing now. The engine was smoking. Pez Rickon and his companions continued to fire. The helicopter spun in a crazy circle, bleeding smoke. For a moment it looked as though it would right itself, but then it lurched, staggering like an eater on a sugar swoon, and fell. It hit the ground with a crunching blow. The propeller threw up clods of dirt and grass. Pez Rickon braced himself for an explosion, but none came. He ran through the smoldering grass, looking for survivors of the missile strike, and above all, his mate. There were dead and dying Froom all around. At last he found Epa Pym. When he saw her, he drew short, his legs turning to mud beneath him. Amidst the carnage, her face was untouched somehow. Epa Pym's beautiful round eyes stared straight ahead. The smooth skin on her face and her long, graceful neck were untouched. Below that, all was a ruin. Burned and bloody, the clothing scorched completely off, her torso and legs nearly melted together into a mass of char. The smell of her roasted flesh hung in the air. Pain clawed up in Pez Rickon's chest. 100 memories seemed to flash through his mind at once. He turned away, unable to bear it, knowing he would call out in anguish. And yet how could he do such a thing, when every one of the surviving Froom had suffered equal or greater losses?
"The flying machine," someone said. "There may be survivors. If they call for help, more humans will come."
There were two survivors on board the crashed helicopter. One was a human, the pilot. She was badly injured. She was pinned in the cockpit, her leg shattered. Her face was pale, but she didn't cry out, and her eyes weren't leaking in that strange way that humans sometimes did when they were in great pain. As Pez Rickon drew his sidearm, she eyed him calmly.
"Mercy, please."
Her voice was quiet, with a slight tremble.
"After what you did at the village, you deserve no mercy," he said. "But I will give you some, anyway."
There was no saving this human female. She could not be extracted from the cockpit. There was nobody in his group of survivors who understood human anatomy. It was indeed a mercy what he would do now. He pressed the barrel of his pistol to her head. She closed her eyes. "I hold you no hatred, but you are my enemy, and either you will die or I will. If I could pull the trigger on your entire race, I would do so. He said none of this. It was such a black thought that he wouldn't have dared voice it. Instead, he told the woman,
"If you have gods, let them do with your soul what they will."
He pulled the trigger. The other survivor presented a problem, a Hrum, a free Hrum. His skin was deep purple, not the faded pink of an eater. No slave, this one. He worked willingly with the humans. Pezrikan had known of such Hrum. They served as marines, as pilots in the Royal Navy. They lived and walked among humans. Pezrikan's fighters had dragged the free Hrum to their chief and now held him up when his body went limp. A fire burned behind them, consuming the corpses of the dead.
"What shall we do with him?" someone asked.
"Prepare a platform," Pezrikan said. "A field temple."
"To which god?"
Pezrikan stared at the prisoner, whose skin flushed so deeply purple now that it appeared black. Firelight flickered off his eyes, which had rolled over, as if he were asleep.
"To Liamkar," Pezrikan said. "The god of death will have his sacrifice."
Chapter 3. Starship Blackbeard. 4 months after the atomic destruction of Yorktown by the Hrum Death Fleet. The Barsa system was swarming with loyalist forces, but Captain Drake didn't disguise his presence as he brought Blackbeard and her task force through the jump point. He wanted a fight and swore he would get one. 2 hours after the jump, he seized one of Lord Malfourne's sugar galleons, dumped the cargo into the void, and sent the prize back through the jump point. A day later, with loyalist forces scurrying to intercept him, he sent Jess Tolvern out with HMS Philistine. Accompanied by a pair of torpedo boats, Tolvern's destroyer bombarded a small navy outpost on the farthest, coldest world in the system. The loyalists fought back tenaciously, repelling multiple attacks. Within 48 hours, two of Malthorn's cruisers, supported by torpedo boats and missile frigates, arrived to relieve the outpost. Tolvern fled for her life. She cloaked Philistine as soon as she'd escaped, making as if wounded and running for the jump point on the farthest reaches of the Barsa system. That was another feint. Drake gave her new orders and sent her barreling toward the inner worlds. To hide her true movements, Drake further split his forces, sending off his mercenary frigates and sloops to harass the shipping lanes. They were pirates, and it was a task they knew too well. Soon, all merchant traffic in the system was flying under heavy escort. 2 more loyalist cruisers jumped into the system to put an end to the threat. Drake took Blackbeard and attacked another galleon. He knocked out its engines, then fought a brief but furious battle against her escorting torpedo boat. The loyalist ship was led by an able commander and struck a blow against Blackbeard's armor at the helm, but the torpedo boat was no match for the heavy cruiser's main guns. A broadside from Blackbeard tore the torpedo boat in two and vented her gases into the void. The galleon it was escorting surrendered. He looted its cargo and let it go. And then Drake went quiet. He cloaked, accelerated to top speed, and reversed course for the far side of the Barsa system. 10 days later, 15 days after arriving in the Barsa system, he arrived at the rendezvous point. Blackbeard was alone while Drake's forces spread havoc elsewhere to disguise his true mission. He'd come to rendezvous with Nigel Rutherford and his cruiser, HMS Vigilant. Where was he? Drake stood at the viewscreen, looking anxiously at the gray-green planet beneath them. It was the outermost of the rocky inner worlds, and girdled with the remains of a small moon. The belt of debris kept them disguised from prying eyes. But after 3 trips around the planet, it was clear that Vigilant and Rutherford were not waiting in orbit. Drake turned to Smythe, his tech officer.
Can you run a sweep?
They'd taken instrument damage during the fight with the torpedo boat, and some of the systems had been offline while tech and engineering performed repairs. I can run anything you want, Smythe said. But the long-range stuff isn't shielded yet. We'll give up our position if we go long.
In that case, keep the search close. 5 million miles. No, keep it under 3.
Yes, sir? 12 hours later, Drake was on the verge of sending Tolvern a subspace to warn her away from Hot Barca until he sent further orders. There would be no attack on the Sugar World without Rutherford. But then came a coded subspace from Rutherford. It was short. It took a good deal of energy to open a temporary wormhole wide enough to send through a packet of data. On our way, 2230. Ready weapons. We may have company. Drake glanced at the time on the console. 1918. 2 hours and change. He reread the message, then told Manx to get the defense grid computer up and called Barker in engineering to warn him.
When did you say?
Came Barker's gruff voice over the comm. The chief of engineering sounded grumpy.
22:30, Drake said. We've got time.
A grunt.
Check again.
Drake looked down at his console and blinked. The time read 22:14. He'd been looking at it moments earlier, and it had read 1918. He'd have sworn it.
What the devil?
We lost Jane in the fight with that torpedo boat, Barker said. She only just came back online and updated the time. You've been operating on pre-dilation. Now it's correct.
Time dilation was minimal at 10% the speed of light, Blackbeard's top speed. At 10%, you lost about 14 minutes per day. Normally, the AI recalculated and adjusted the shipboard clocks automatically so they didn't fall behind real time. But they'd spent 10 days galloping across the solar system, and all that time, Jane had been down. Drake had been operating on pre-dilation time and never realized it. He uttered an oath and told Barker to get to it, then snapped new orders at Smythe and Manx, who set about their work with fresh urgency. Cap was in the pilot's chair, but he wanted Nib Pym on deck in case they entered combat, so he recalled the Hroom pilot from his sleep cycle.
"I've got vigilance, sir,"
Smythe said from the scanners as Nib Pym came onto the bridge, blinking away the sleep and rubbing his long, thin fingers over his smooth scalp.
"Is she alone?"
Drake asked. Smythe frowned and studied his console. Drake's throat was dry, and there was the buzz in his head that he felt before battle, when all his nerves were tingling, his senses heightened. Untold millennia of evolution carried by his genes from old Earth readied him for this life-and-death struggle.
"Yes,"
Smythe said at last. "She's alone." Drake felt as though an electric current had been turned off. Nib Pym had sat down, moving Cap to the subpilot's chair. Nib Pym's fingers flew over his console. Cap rubbed at the lion tattoos on her forearm, staring hard at the viewscreen, which had just captured Vigilant's shadow and was further resolving the image with every scan. Cap let out her breath in a long blow.
"Bloody hell, Smythe, don't make us wait like that."
"The scanners hadn't..." Smythe started to protest, then stopped.
"Wait. Yes, there she is, another ship. It's Melbourne, sir."
"King's balls," Cap said.
"And 3 bloody harpoons, look at 'em."
HMS Melbourne was an aggressor-class cruiser, not quite as powerful as either Blackbeard or Vigilant, but strong enough. And she was traveling with 3 harpoon-class destroyers. Who was captaining Melbourne? Was it still McGregor? He was an able commander. It would be a fight. The viewscreen changed over. On came Nigel Rutherford's grim visage.
"Drake," he said in that cold, almost arrogant tone, "I've brought you a small gift." "I see that," Drake said. "But a cruiser and 3 destroyers is awfully generous of you."
"You are welcome."
A shrug. "I forgot to acknowledge your birthday. Let this be recompense." "Why, thank you."
"Keep your location hidden. I don't think you've been spotted. I'll come down as if trying to shield myself behind all those moons, and you can spring an ambush. Here's what you should do..."
"Captain Rutherford?" Drake interrupted, his tone firm. Rutherford stared back, and the muscles tightened on his jaw. It was a challenge. What better plan was there? Drake's forces were a motley collection of paid mercenaries, pirates really, and rebellious elements of the Royal Navy, like Nigel Rutherford. Drake and Rutherford had spent a year as enemies after Drake's mutiny, and though they were now on the same side after Malthorn's treacherous grab for the throne, there was still friction between them. In principle, Drake was the head of the fleet. In practice, Drake and Rutherford were often vying for control. Tolvern had urged Drake to declare himself admiral. That would settle command once and for all. Drake resisted. These things must be done properly. He wouldn't have a civil war within a civil war. Drake waited, and at last Rutherford nodded.
"Yes, sir, your command."
That was all Drake had needed, and he was willing to concede everything else.
"It is an excellent plan, Captain. We will follow your suggestion."
Soon enough, Rutherford was slowing vigilant as he approached the planet. The enemy cruiser and the three escorting destroyers slowed too, but only to launch an initial barrage of missiles. Too far out, those missiles would do little good. Drake hid behind one of the larger moon fragments. HMS Melbourne got greedy and chased after Vigilant without waiting for her destroyers to get into position. At that moment, Drake brought Blackbeard into the open. It took a moment to drop the cloaks and get the batteries hot, but Melbourne didn't spot them until it was too late. The enemy cruiser was blasting at Vigilant, now within range. She swung wide to show her main guns, and that exposed her to Blackbeard. Drake fired two torpedoes. They whipped past hastily launched countermeasures and slammed into Melbourne's rear. The enemy cruiser snapped off missiles in response, which Blackbeard swatted away. Drake ordered the main cannon readied as they came to. By now, Blackbeard was only a few hundred miles distant.
"Fire!"
Drake ordered. Blackbeard let loose with a broadside. The shot tore into Melbourne's shields. Another torpedo disabled the engines. Drake expected Vigilant to wheel on Melbourne. With the enemy vessel wounded, the two rebel cruisers would shortly finish her off. But Rutherford continued, accelerating now, as he skimmed above the atmosphere of the planet. He came at one of the destroyers, now isolated and vulnerable. The destroyer fled. Melbourne fired her own guns, and she and Blackbeard exchanged fire for several minutes. But Blackbeard had gained the upper hand in the initial engagement and pressed her advantage. Drake's crew was readying another broadside when Captain MacGregor surrendered. Cap pumped her fist.
"Got you, you bastards!"
Nib Pym gave a pleased hoot, and Smythe, Manx, and Oglethorpe slapped each other on the backs, grinning. Even wounded, Melbourne was a terrific prize. Repaired and with a new crew, she'd be a powerful addition to the rebel navy. By now, the three enemy destroyers had regrouped, but not to fight. Instead, they fled toward Hot Barsa. There, they no doubt figured, they could be protected by the guns of the orbital fortresses while they awaited orders. Drake watched their flight with dismay. That was all wrong. Clearing the region around the planet of Hot Barsa itself was the reason for all of these fights across the system. To pin down Lord Malthorn's forces, tens of millions of miles from where they'd be needed. Having scattered the destroyers, Rutherford brought Vigilant into position to guard Blackbeard's rear, should the remaining vessels mount one last bid to free Melbourne. When the threat faded, Vigilant swung around to take possession of the prize.
"Smythe, send Tolvern a subspace," Drake said, still worried about those destroyers.
"Yes, sir. Should I tell her the gig's up?"
Drake hesitated. He touched the console.
"Jane, I need numbers. Estimate Tolvern's arrival time at Hot Barsa."
"Unknown ship,"
came the cool voice of the computer. She sounded almost petulant, as if she knew what he was asking but meant him to spell it out.
"Don't be so blasted literal-minded," he said. "HMS Philistine. According to her last known course, give me an arrival time."
It took several long moments before the response came back. Drake knew this was because Jane had only just come back online and was, no doubt, expending much of her computation power running diagnostics and repair, but it seemed like pure stubbornness. She was slow enough that Cap and Nib Pim had already calculated the similar data for the three destroyers by running it through the nav computer, although, admittedly, this was much less precise. Tolvern had a window, a very, very tight window. Drake's instincts said no, but they might not get another chance. This was their opportunity to fatally weaken Lord Malthorn. They had to take it.
"Sir, do you still want that subspace?" Smythe asked, his hands poised above his console.
"Captain," Cap protested, "you can't let Tolvern stand against them destroyers. They'll eat her alive. We'll go after them, us and Vigilant. We'll settle their hash."
No, because there was still a powerful task force nearby, three cruisers and support craft. Blackbeard and Vigilant needed to harass these ships out in the space lanes to keep them from either crushing the mercenaries and their diversion or joining the protective cordon around Hot Barsa.
"Subspace channel is open, sir," Smythe said. "It's eating power if you want to send a message."
Drake decided.
"Tell Tolvern what's coming and when, but she is to proceed as planned."
A grim silence settled over the bridge as Smythe moved to comply. Tolvern had served as Blackbeard's commander and Drake's second until a few months ago. She'd been given her own ship after the Battle of Albion, and Lieutenant Oglethorpe had taken her place. They all knew her and worried. Drake stared hard at the console and the fading signature of those three destroyers still accelerating toward Hot Barsa. Three orbital fortresses, and now a trio of destroyers. Jess Tolvern would have to face them all. Only 2 months at the helm of her first command. It might be her last.
Chapter 4. 2 days after receiving the subspace warning from Captain Drake, Jess Tolvern stood in the engineering bay, watching two muscular corporals load the away pod with supplies. The pod was made to hold 8, but would only carry 4 on this mission. The rest of the space would be stuffed from floor to ceiling with supplies to keep the away team alive while it completed its mission. Science officer Noah Brockett stood next to her, rubbing at his stubble. More peach fuzz than stubble, really, a little tuft growing on the edge of his chin. He had bags under his eyes from working so hard the last few days, making him look, for the first time since she'd met him, like an adult and not a brainy teenager. In reality, he was 25, not much younger than herself.
"Glad it's not me going out in that tin can," Brockett said.
"It's not so bad," she said, "assuming you don't die in transit."
"That's what I'm talking about. I saw what nearly happened to you at Albion."
During the attack on Albion, Drake had used 2 away pods to assemble a rescue team on a small sloop. In calm circumstances, precision equipment and precise computation rendered such ship-to-ship transfers routine. A slingshot flung you toward another ship, and a hook and net brought you in. But under fire it was hell. The little sloop had rolled to avoid incoming fire, and one of the pods missed the transfer and fell into the atmosphere. It burned as it went down. The other, Tolvern's, had nearly suffered the same fate. She'd been inches from death.
"This is safer," she said. "It's shielded so it won't be destroyed in the atmosphere. It has a parachute. Even if it's off course, it's got to land somewhere."
"That somewhere could be the ocean," Brockett said. "Or it smashes into the side of a mountain. Or it lands and the first people to step out are carried off by lurkers. I lived on Hot Barsa. I know what's down there."
And Brockett had lived in the highlands at Malthorn's laboratories, where he'd been synthesizing the sugar antidote. Even there it was sweltering, with plenty of nasty creatures hanging about. Lurkers, pouncers, mosquitoes the size of birds, carnivorous eels. The lowlands would be a special sort of hell for humans. Only Sal Epis, the home translator for the mission, would feel comfortable in those conditions. Though she hadn't seemed overly pleased about her assignment now that Tolvern thought about it. One of the corporals drove a forklift containing a flat of refrigerator-size coolers across the cargo bay. Brockett walked alongside, his hand against the coolers to steady them.
"Careful," he said. "That's a lot of work in there."
"Keep back, kid, unless you want your toes mashed," the driver said.
The corporal had a deep, masculine voice, and the stubble on his face was thick and dark, the kind that seemed poised to bloom into a full-size beard if it weren't shaved day and night. The contrast with the science officer's peach fuzz was telling, but Brockett wouldn't be dissuaded.
"You didn't tie this down properly," he said, as the forklift stopped and the man jumped down to help his partner load the coolers onto the pod. "Next load, use the straps."
"Listen, kid, I've been doing this since you were in diapers, and I don't mean 2 weeks ago. So before you go telling me how to do my job..."
"Do what he says, Corporal,"
Tolvern interrupted. The corporal blinked and stared at her.
"Aye, sir. Sorry, sir."
The man returned to his work.
"I don't know," Brockett confided to Tolvern. "Maybe I should go down instead of Henry. He's awfully young."
Henry Jukes was Brockett's new lab assistant, and even younger than his boss. 19, was that right? Looked about 12, to be honest. Henry had been a math whiz studying at the Naval Academy in Juneau, but he'd been home on Saxony for semester break when Civil War broke out. He'd quickly enlisted to join the rebellion. She didn't think Henry was overly political, but throw him in a lab full of cool computers and machines that whirred and beeped, and he'd do anything for the cause.
"Does Henry know how to synthesize the antidote?" she asked. "Not yet, no. So far as I know, I'm the only one who can, unless that Hroom General has figured it out. We don't know if Mose Driz has managed or not, but he's got other troubles to worry about. He's still fighting his own civil war, and Apex is biting at his haunches."
There was another consideration. In addition to internal struggles with the Hroom Death Cult and the attacks by the savage alien race known as Apex, the military commander of the Hroom Empire was himself a sugar eater. Captain Drake had given the Empire the antidote, a great weapon in its struggle against human slavers, but it was unclear if Mose Driz had done anything with it. In any event, the sugar world of Hot Barca was inaccessible to the Empire. It was up to Drake's fleet to spread chaos behind Albion lines.
"I could do it," Brockett insisted. "I've been on Hot Barca. I've dealt with Hroom before. I could explain how the antidote works better than Henry."
"Henry will go down," Tolvern said. "We can't risk losing you."
"Yes, Captain."
In spite of his brave words, Brockett sounded relieved. The comlink warned Tolvern that they were beginning their deceleration as they approached Hot Barca. Once they arrived, Tolvern had less than an hour to send the away pod to the surface and get out. Then the three destroyers Drake had warned her about would arrive. Tolvern touched her ear and told the gunnery to man all stations. Cloaking would shortly come down, and they'd better be ready to go hot. When that was done, she called Henry Jukes, Sal Epis, and the two marines who'd be accompanying them to the surface.
"Collect your armaments and personal gear and make your way to engineering. I want you strapped down by 0800.
The orbital fortresses held their fire as Philistine approached. She was one destroyer, and though her cannons were warm and her missile batteries exposed, she wasn't shooting. The rebel craft wasn't strong enough to slug it out with a fort, and so the individual commanders seemed content to wait. Tolvern's tech officer failed to decode the Navy transmissions, but she could easily imagine what they said. Perhaps the destroyer wished to surrender. Several vessels had changed allegiances since the Civil War began. Or perhaps it was a feint, and there was a heavier force cloaked and approaching from the opposite direction. Either way, the forts were strong enough to pummel Philistine into submission. Yet they had no support craft of their own, since these were out fighting the multiple attacks on the system. Better to sit and wait, they seemed to be thinking. Another hour, no longer, and three loyalist destroyers would come to Hot Barca's aid. Tolvern was happy to encourage this thinking as long as possible. She didn't need long. In fact, she didn't want to fight at all,
only drop the pod into the atmosphere and scoot for cover. And so Tolvern brought her ship straight in, as if she had nothing to hide. She sent a communication to the orbital defenses, but garbled, meant to sow confusion, nothing more. At first it seemed to work. But when she was 100,000 miles out and approaching one of the planet's small moons, the enemy opened fire. It was a probing attack, a single missile from Fort Gamma, meant to flush out her intentions, no doubt. She ordered countermeasures, then squawked a protest, this time ungarbled. "Don't shoot at us, we're peaceful." The enemy didn't buy it. Fort Gamma resembled a giant, lumpy, baked potato about 10 miles long, and missiles and torpedoes now launched along a broad front. Tolvern clenched her handrests on the bridge of Philistine. This was it, her first combat at the helm of her own ship. For a moment, panic came clawing up from her gut, threatening to leave her frozen in terror and indecision. But she heard Captain Drake's calm voice in her mind, imagined how he would respond. Her fear vanished as quickly as it had arisen. At the same time, her crew was already performing as ordered. The pilot changed the angle of approach to minimize their vulnerability. The tech officer and the gunnery launched countermeasures. Fire control systems answered fire with fire. Soon, missiles were detonating on the surface of the fort. "Hold the cannon," Tolvern said. Her voice sounded calm, authoritative, a voice to be obeyed. "I want them to think we'll be swinging past for another attack." By now, they'd nearly cleared the first fortress and had somehow avoided taking any damage to their shields. In a moment, they'd come into range of two more forts, but she didn't intend to wait for them to appear. She opened a channel to the away pod, poised for launch in the engineering bay. "We start the countdown sequence in 3 minutes." "Ready and waiting," came Corporal Martin's gruff voice. She was the Marine leading the surface expedition. While the channel was still open, Tolvern heard Henry Jukes' high, nervous voice. Brockett's young assistant sounded terrified. Hard to blame him, he was about to be slingshotted in an unpowered away pod toward the planet's surface at 3,000 miles an hour, while enemies tried to blow him to smithereens. "Captain," someone broke in from engineering over the comm, "we have incoming hostiles." "Incoming hostiles? What? Where?" Tolvern's fingers worked the console. Couldn't be the destroyers, they were still too far out. Ground craft? Something hidden on the far side of the planet? Drake's entire fleet had been studying Hot Barsa from a distance for weeks now, and there should be nothing here. Not so much as a frigate.
"What the devil are you talking about?" she demanded. "Where?"
"The fort." She'd been ignoring the red lights, the flashing warnings, and the heat signatures along the schematic of the small moon. The fort was throwing all sorts of destruction their way, but it was the responsibility of other crew members to neutralize those attacks. Except this. Now Tolvern understood why the fortress had seemed so calm. It had been hiding a secret. 3 torpedo boats, each a third the size of Philistine, launched one by one from a hidden hangar on the side of the moon. They must have been hiding there, already manned and engines hot. In deep space, torpedo boats of this size escorted larger ships. They were not swift enough or powerful enough to brawl with even a modest-sized ship like the Rebel Destroyer. But here, protected by the massive guns of orbital fortresses, their maneuverability and acceleration made them a lethal addition to the battle. Tolvern didn't have time to curse the intelligence failure that had dropped the 3 ships into her lap. She was crying for evasive maneuvers. One of the enemy craft descended immediately into the stratosphere over Hot Barsa's northern continent and blocked the destroyer's descent toward the surface. Launch the pod from here, and it would merely be target practice for enemy guns. The other 2 torpedo boats came at Philistine from the rear, forcing her toward a second fortress now swinging around the planet, already launching missiles. Philistine shuddered. "Class 3 detonation," the computer said in a dry voice. 32% damage to the shields. Kinetic fire raked her underbelly. Missiles and torpedoes raced out to meet her.
"Pull up!" Tolvern cried to her pilot. "Get us out of here!"
The pod was unlaunched, still in the engineering bay where she'd left it, and there it would stay. The mission was already aborted. She slammed her fist on the handrest.
"Damn it!"
Then, embarrassed about her outburst, she concentrated on getting out alive. The engines had taken a hit, and they'd suffered a slow leak to the plasma containment system. She had to build a whole lot of speed before she lost too much juice. With no other options, she pointed away from the three incoming destroyers and accelerated at top speed in the opposite direction. She held her breath, waiting for the torpedo boats to follow, or worse, for scans to reveal new enemies incoming from this direction. No, thank God. Once they'd escaped the final pursuing fire from Hot Barsa's forts, she sent an emergency subspace to where Drake and Rutherford were rendezvousing. She'd failed. Worse, she'd taken so much damage that she'd need help getting out of the system alive. Finally, Tolvern called the away team to give them the bad news. They'd been down there quietly waiting out the shattering attacks in the isolation of the pod. Unsure whether they'd be blown apart or launched without warning toward the planet to complete their mission, all while taking fire. Henry must be white with terror, poor kid. Corporal Martin and the others must be ready to strangle him. There was no answer. Great, the pod systems must be fried. She told engineering to send someone to give the away team the bad news in person and assess damage. Was the pod even salvageable? Someone from engineering responded a few moments later.
"Multiple hull breaches along the engineering bay. We've almost got it contained, but..." "Yeah, it don't look good."
Tolvern's mouth went dry.
"Tell me."
"Looks like it punctured the away pod," the man said. "No life readings on board. Afraid we lost them, Captain."
Chapter 5. A few weeks later, Captain Drake waited in the war room as the other members of his council arrived one by one. He had to control the tempo of this meeting. He couldn't give out all of the information he was sitting on. If he did, the loss in the Barsa system and their subsequent flight to San Pablo, harried and pursued until friendly mercenaries showed up to tip the balance, would seem like the beginning of Lord Malthorn's final victory. Tolvern arrived first, her eyes averted, shame-faced. From her perspective, it had been a debacle. She'd not only failed to launch the pod, but seen her away team killed. Her destroyer, Philistine, had barely escaped and was now being towed to San Pablo for extensive repairs. A few months in command, and she was already bereft of a ship, her crew scattered to other vessels in the fleet. Rutherford came next, alone. He'd wanted to bring Pitsfield, his second in command, but the war room was already going to be crowded, and Drake didn't need the distraction. Rutherford's mouth formed a grim line, and he grumbled the barest greeting at the other two. Next came Catherine Cates, now captain of her own cruiser. She was roughly Tolvern's age, and during the initial fleet organization on Saxony, there had been a discussion of whether to put Cates on the cruiser and Tolvern on the destroyer, or vice versa. It was a major promotion for both women. Cates had at least commanded a torpedo boat before, and that settled it. She was given the powerful HMS Richmond. Rutherford had first elevated the young woman, and his decision now looked prescient. Cates had fought with distinction in the most recent action, single-handedly holding off enemy forces while the rest of Drake's fleet jumped for safety, and then coming through unscathed herself. Rutherford now greeted Cates as if she were a full peer, in contrast to how he'd addressed Tolvern. Finally, Drake called in three others from his crew, his pilot, Nib Pym, science officer Noah Brockett, and Henny Cap. Cap looked nervous as she entered, uncomfortable. She was from a low background, raised in the working-class neighborhoods of Yorktown. On Saxony, Rutherford had barely tolerated her. Drake willed both of them to hold their tongues. Rutherford leaned back in his chair.
Well, we failed. Now what?
Drake considered how much of his new intelligence to admit, and how quickly. Best to start with the good news.
Not a failure. We lost 2 mercenary frigates, but we picked up another cruiser.
Lost didn't mean destroyed. It meant they'd abandoned the fight, taken their money, and run. No doubt they'd return to piracy. They might even prey on Drake's own shipping out of Saxony.
You mean Melbourne? Rutherford asked.
Will she even fly? 6 months in the docks, and how will we pay for it?
That's the good news, Drake said. We got a communication from Rodriguez in the yards. He'll fix her for £8,000.
Rutherford stared.
After the beating we gave her? Are you sure the villain doesn't intend to steal her from us? And when?
7 months, admittedly.
Rutherford threw up his hands.
There you go, he grunted. And I suppose Tolvern will captain it? She got her first horse shot out from under her, so why not give her a better one?
More good news, Drake said. Philistine is in better shape. Most of the damage proved superficial. He says 3 weeks and she's back in space. We do some final in-orbit repairs, and she's good to go.
Tolvern was shifting in her seat, and he was already getting off track. He needed to cut this off before she offered to resign her commission, and Rutherford tried to accept.
We've got other worries, Drake said. First among them, Dreadnought.
This got their attention. The word hung in the air. Vice Admiral Thomas Lord Malthorne's battleship had taken a beating, first at the hands of the Froome sloops of war, and then from the rebellious ships fighting his attempt to destroy his former allies. Floating in orbit around Albion, it was still the most powerful ship in known space, but they'd assumed it would be in repairs for the better part of a year. Malthorne was fighting on multiple fronts, and the atomic bombing had destroyed the planet-side headquarters of the Royal Navy, together with much of the material and personnel who could have done the repairs. Unfortunately, they'd all been wrong on that score.
Dreadnought has left orbit, Drake said.
One of our spies on Fort William said she shipped out 3 days ago.
Bloody hell, Cap murmured.
Our source says Malthorne is taking a pass around the sun to test her systems, Drake continued. Once she's proven spaceworthy, he'll load her up with marines, collect an escort, and set out on an expedition.
But where?
The planet of Saxony, I should imagine, Rutherford said. Malthorne wouldn't leave orbit for anything less than total victory. With the unrest on Albion, there is no assurance that another claimant won't seize the throne in his absence. For such a risk, the reward must be very great indeed.
Could be Mercia, Tolvern said. The planet is not firmly in either camp yet. A show of force would compel allegiance to the crown.
I don't think so, Drake said in response to Tolvern. Malthorne has offered Mercia a carrot. Trade concessions, new estates on Froome worlds for Mercian nobility. All if she remains neutral. Bash Saxony with a big enough stick, and Mercia might decide that carrot looks pretty sweet.
Quite right, Rutherford said. One swift blow against the only world we control, and we are finished.
Then we return to Saxony, sir?
Cates asked. The question wasn't directed to Drake, but to Rutherford.
What choice do we have? Rutherford said. If we lose Saxony, we are reduced to a fleet without port or resources. May as well turn to piracy. We'd be finished as opposition to the Lord Admiral.
We can reach Saxony with plenty of time to set up our defenses, Kate said. But we'll be forced to leave Philistine and Melbourne on San Pablo.
Aren't we getting ahead of ourselves? Tolvern asked. Captain Drake hasn't ordered any such movement.
We have to defend Saxony, the other woman said. Unless you'd see us reduced to piracy.
Cap leaned back in her chair and rubbed at the lion tattoos on her forearm.
And what's wrong with a bit of piracy? Cut off that bastard Sugar, take his coin. We'll hire all the mercenaries we need out here.
That is absolute rubbish, Rutherford said.
Cap shrugged and leaned back farther. Any more and she'd dump her backside on the floor.
Saxony is a bit of rock. What do we care for it?
That bit of rock has 50 million of our people on it, Kate said. Drake wanted to let them talk it out, interested in opinions and options, but it seemed that the room was dividing into two camps, and he needed to cut that off before it led to a split.
"Enough arguing about Saxony," he said. "And, Ensign, you will kindly sit up. This isn't the mess hall." Cap did so at once. Nib Pym cleared his throat with a sort of humming.
"May I ask about Hot Barsa? Are you intending now to abandon it?"
"We've still got 200,000 doses of antidote," Brockett said. "We could make another go of it." Needless to say, both the former sugar addict and the scientist who'd been working to duplicate the sugar antidote had been all in favor of moving directly against Malthorn's holdings on Hot Barsa. Turning over the antidote to the free room on the surface could swiftly weaken the Admiral's hold on the world.
"We made an attempt," Rutherford said. "It failed. It is time to turn to other options."
"It shouldn't have failed," Tolvern said. "It was well conceived. I never counted on those torpedo boats. Caught me off guard, damn it. I should have wondered. Those forts were too bloody passive, too smug. It was obvious they were going to spring a trap."
"Any one of us would have made the same assumptions," Rutherford said. "You deserve no blame. You were a single destroyer, and you fought well."
Tolvern seemed to appreciate this nod to her abilities. Some of the tension dissolved from her features. "Still, we were close. We nearly launched the pod. Now the team is dead, and we are several light years away."
Brockett leaned over and spoke in a low voice for Nib Pym's benefit. The alien nodded solemnly. Meanwhile, Cates brought up something on a hand computer, which she showed to Rutherford. Tolvern repeated her self-criticism. Cap brushed it aside. There was some discussion of what, if anything, might have been done to get past those forts. While these side conversations continued, Drake raised a screen on the table. He brought up a map of the sector, with the human systems stretching along the left side in green, blue, and yellow, and the Froom Empire a massive swath of red on the right and above. The size of the respective regions was deceptive, as many of those Froom systems had collapsed into sugar addiction and civil war. He pressed a few buttons, and the colors changed to reflect this. This information would be familiar to most of them, except for a sickly orange underneath and to the rear. It stabbed through the red, already close to bisecting the entire Froom Empire. Tolvern spotted it first.
"What is that?"
"Apex. They've launched a massive assault on the Empire."
"When did this happen?" Rutherford asked.
"When did it happen, or when did I hear of it? The news came yesterday. General Mose Driz sent me a subspace message asking for help. Seemed to have begun 4 months ago. More or less at the same time we were fighting the Death Fleet." This quieted the room. They couldn't help but notice the length of that salient into Froom territory. That was a dozen systems right there in only 4 months, all gobbled up by the predatory alien race.
"And the Froom have the audacity to demand our help?" Rutherford said.
"Yorktown is a smoldering radioactive ruin thanks to them. What nerve to ask our assistance at this moment."
"That was not the general's doing," Nib Pym said. "That was a cult dedicated to the god of death."
"Still Froom," Kate said. "There isn't one person in Albion space who would lift a finger to save them right now." "I don't know about that," Tolvern said. "But we can't help them, even if we wanted to. Dreadnought is readying a jump. Malthorn is coming at us. Are we forgetting that? The Froom are on their own, whether they want it or not."
"But if we help them," Nib Pym began.
"Are you daft?" Cap said. "We can't even help ourselves. What are we going to do for the general?"
"You're all missing a critical detail," Drake said. He pushed a button on the console, and the map flipped upside down. They were now looking at it from below. Take away that familiar perspective, and you could see that orange gash through Froom space for what it was.
"My God," Rutherford said.
Drake nodded. "That's right. It's no attempt to divide the Empire. That attack is meant to get at the humans."
They knew precious little about the bird-like apex.
There were apparently two related genetically engineered species in the alien civilization. They had energy weapons that could penetrate standard Terillium armor. They exterminated their enemies rather than conquered them, literally ate them when they could. The intelligence was sketchy, but it seemed that Apex wars were a struggle for dominance. Humans had only faced them in battle once. Drake, Rutherford, and the pirate ships had defeated a small Apex force with a bit of trickery. Now, it seemed, the aliens wanted to get at the human systems and see who was the true Apex predator of the sector. To Apex, the Froom were just the carcass over which the two predators would be struggling, like a wolf pack and a grizzly fighting over a dead moose.
"I figure we have 4 or 5 months before they reach human space," Drake continued. "They'll tear through these outer systems. The New Dutch are scattered, and the Ladino disorganized. The pirates and mercenaries will run. They won't stand and fight. Maybe another month after that, before Apex reaches the Albion Worlds."
"What options does that leave us?" Rutherford said. "Surrender to Lord Malthorn, or keep fighting him and face extermination as a race? It's a devil's choice."
"About Hot Barsa," Nib Pym began.
"That plan is dead," Kate said grimly. "I think we can all agree on that much."
Rutherford, Tolvern, and Cap nodded. Among the humans, only Brockett looked uncertain, and that was because he seemed to have pinned his hopes on his sugar antidote. Drake thought it time to inject new energy into the failed plan.
"Not entirely, no," he said. "I would like to consider another move on Hot Barsa."
"With all due respect," Rutherford began, with an acidic edge to his voice that indicated a certain lack of respect. "Lord Malthorn's main flaw as a commander was his insistence on pursuing unwise expeditions. It's how the Death Fleet got through. Malthorn wasted time fighting pirates when he should have been returning to Albion with all haste."
"That is irrelevant," Tolvern said.
"Hardly irrelevant. That is precisely what Drake is proposing here. We had the element of surprise and failed anyway. Now the enemy will be prepared. We would need a direct assault with all of our resources to take Hot Barsa. Even then our chance of success is not assured."
"That much is true," Drake agreed. "I wouldn't expect it to be easy."
"And to what end?" Rutherford said. "We foment rebellion on Hot Barsa. That takes fruition in a year or two, as slaves become immune to sugar, flee the plantations and join the slave revolt. Malthorn loses his source of revenue. Meanwhile, the war ends."
"Because while we're at Hot Barsa, Malthorn seizes Saxony," Kate said. "We disrupt his sugar plantations, he ends our entire rebellion."
Rutherford gestured at her with a short nod, as if her words were so obviously true that they didn't even need a verbal agreement.
"And even if it's all a feint, if Dreadnought is incapable of jumping from Albion, what about Apex? The aliens will be at our throats, and we'll be no closer to defeating Malthorn. Humans will be divided, then destroyed."
"You are forgetting the psychological impact of attacking Hot Barsa," Drake said. "Spreading rebellion was never a long-term plan. With Dreadnought back in the space lanes, it's more likely than ever to have the desired effect."
He explained his strategy. They would gather whatever mercenary forces they could muster, pull the other ships away from Saxony, and bring everything at Hot Barsa. They'd drop a team to the surface, spread the antidote far and wide, and send taunting messages to Albion, boasting of what they'd accomplished. Malthorn's weakness was pride. He'd earlier let the Froom Death Fleet slip through while he launched a punitive expedition against pirates. On another occasion, he'd arrested Drake's parents and murdered Drake's sister to retaliate for the burning of his manor house on Hot Barsa. He'd sent Rutherford far and wide to track down and kill Drake. The Lord Admiral was a man who acted out of anger and revenge.
"What will he do when he learns we've all but abandoned Saxony?" Drake said. "Will he take Dreadnought and seize the planet? Or will he ignore it and come after us?"
"I think he'll come. With his sugar plantation threatened, I'm almost certain of it."
There was a long, full pause.
"That is a terrible gamble," Rutherford said at last.
We are reduced to such wages, Drake said. We must defeat Malthorn, and do so quickly. If not, Apex will arrive to find us weaker than the Hrum. Just another carcass to pick over.
Then it will end at Hot Bassa, Rutherford said. A final naval battle. The winner leads the defense, the loser dies.
I'd suggest surrender if I thought Malthorn would take it, Drake said. It would be worth it to save Albion.
He would take our surrender, Rutherford said. Under generous terms, no doubt. But then he would renege on the arrangement and hang the lot of us. The defense of our homeworld be damned.
Yes, exactly that.
Rutherford glanced at Cates. She raised her eyebrows and gave a little shrug. Drake looked to his own people. Nib Pym seemed eager, while Brockett looked more circumspect. He would be imagining his own role in this. With Henry Jukes dead, there was nobody else who could fill the critical role on the away team. Cap and Tolvern looked ready to go along with whatever Drake suggested.
Then it's settled, Drake said, without waiting for Rutherford to give his official assent. The time for that had passed. Drake had listened, he had shared information, and now he would decide.
Send out the word. There's no disguising our plan this time. We'll come in like we mean it.
It was a single desperate roll of the dice. God help him if the numbers came up wrong.
Chapter 6 2 days later, Drake and Tolvern were planetside, standing on the blistering tarmac at the San Pablo spaceyards. Isabel Vargas's pirate frigate, Outlaw, sat shimmering in the heat. It had been repaired from the damage of the Battle of Albion, and now Vargas had returned to port to install a new missile battery. She stood with her hands on her hips, seemingly oblivious to the heat, shouting up at the crew doing final maintenance, while Drake looked over the guns. Vargas's mechanical eye rotated to follow Drake as he reached up to touch the pterillium armor of the underbelly. It felt sound enough, that slightly yielding surface that could nevertheless absorb laser energy and turn away massive explosions, but it was black and scarred, the repairs like makeup over a badly burned face.
"I'll paint a belly next time around," Vargas said.
"You managed to repaint the shark teeth on the nose," Tolvern said.
"I got to look at the important details."
"You've even put blood dripping off the teeth," Tolvern said. "Anyone ever get close enough to see it?"
Vargas grinned.
"By the time you see the blood, you're being boarded. But it's for the yards. Reminds people not to mess with me.
Menacing, wouldn't you say?"
"Menacing, all right, but also one ugly piece of work. Back when Ed Robertson of the Royal Navy flew her, she was a sleek corvette, a wolf meant to hunt in a pack. Now, rechristened Outlaw and overhauled several times, she more resembled a giant horned lizard. Tough enough, but no beauty to her." Isabel Vargas had once compared herself to her ship. Her sister, Katerina, was the beautiful one. The younger of the two, Katerina, had received a posh education on Albion and didn't have a face marred by injury. Drake thought Isabel overly hard on herself. There was still plenty of beauty in her. And where was Katerina anyway? Some distant system, raising her secret pioneering fleet. Those ships, and especially Katerina's own Orient Tiger, would have been a powerful ally in the fight. Isabel, sturdy and dependable as her ship, was still here. That counted for a good deal in Drake's book.
"You'll be ready to fly?" he asked.
"I could leave right now if I needed to," Vargas said. "In fact, if I hadn't been scraping around for your fleet, I'd probably be in orbit already. It's kept me away from my work."
"Any troubles finding people?"
"Nah, you've got a good reputation. Plenty of blokes happy to fly for you, so long as you hand over the gold up front. And you're the one giving orders, not that stuffed shirt Rutherford." In many ways, Drake was as much of a stuffed shirt as Rutherford, or had been anyway. He'd never meant to consort with pirates and mercenaries, that was for sure. But he'd tried to carry over as much honor as he could. He paid his debts. He thrashed anyone who crossed him, and thrashed those who crossed his loyal compatriots. Fly next to Blackbeard and you might be killed in battle. Those were the risks. But you'd never be cheated. I want my guns aligned before we launch, Vargas said. Easier to fix here than in orbit. But the other ships are coming out of the hangar. Take a look. Tell me if there's anything you don't like. Some of the craft were already out, sitting on the tarmac, while forklifts and stevedores hauled in fresh supplies. Others came creeping out, pulled by lorries. Drake and Tolvern took a walk to inspect them. Drake was already perspiring before they set out, but sweat soon streamed down his temples and from his armpits. San Pablo had been a homeworld, but this western continent was now given over to Ladino settlements. It had been warm last time they'd visited these yards, but the hot season had arrived. It was not only baking beneath the direct sun, but humid, like a steam bath.
"I suppose I should get used to the weather," Tolvern said. "It's pretty much like this all the time in the lowlands of Hot Barsa."
"It was brutal enough in the highlands."
He eyed her.
"When did you figure it out?"
"That you were sending me on the away team, about 3 seconds after you said we'd be going back."
Tolvern unfastened her vest to let it hang open. Sweat dampened the linen shirt underneath.
"Your first away team was killed. We need a new one. Brockett is a given. Nobody else understands the antidote now that Henry is dead. I figured you were eyeing Nib Pym to replace Sal Epus. You need a loyal Hroom translator. Cap could be your firepower. That leaves only a commander."
"And it turns out that I have an able military leader who is temporarily bereft of her ship. She is the logical choice for the mission."
"Ha, Abel? Not so sure about that part. I had one command and I blew it."
"Could have been worse," Drake said. "You could have lost your ship."
"Didn't I? It's out of commission for weeks."
Tolvern tossed her head to the two largest hangars in the yard. Rodriguez was repairing the crippled HMS Melbourne in one, and in the other Tolvern's destroyer.
"Let me tell you about my first command," Drake said. "I took the helm at Fort William. I was supposed to leave Albion Orbit, take a swing around Thor to get the feel for my ship and new crew, and then rendezvous with the task force under Captain Peter Dorr to jump to Phandalus. Do you know Dorr?"
Tolvern shook her head.
"He's retired now, an old fellow, and I served under him, with mutton chop whiskers so big they needed their own berth. A perpetually stiff upper lip, and eyebrows drawn up in disdain, as if the universe itself was an affront to his dignity. So much starch in his uniform he could have been killed in battle, and it would have kept him propped up at the helm. Not the sort of man you wanted to keep waiting. So, when one of my new engines malfunctioned, I didn't return to Fort William like I should have. Instead, I ran it hot to get to the rendezvous in time, figuring we were putting into port a few days after the jump, where I could see it repaired. Engineering warned me. I ignored the warning. 10 days into my first command, I had to dump plasma to keep my ship from blowing up."
Tolvern laughed. "That's pretty embarrassing, all right."
"Oh, it gets worse. Imagine this. We were nearly at jump speed when I had to dump, so now I tell Dorr to go through, and I'll meet him on the other side. I can make it to port on one engine, no problem. He goes through, and engineering tells me I need to squeeze out a bit more speed, or I won't make it through the jump. So I run my second engine hot."
"Don't tell me you didn't make it."
"Oh, I made it. The engine didn't, though. We arrived dead in the water. Nothing but auxiliary power. I had to be towed."
Tolvern winced.
"Ouch. Why have I never heard this story before?"
"If it had happened to you, would you be spreading it around?" Drake remembered the smirks on the faces of the Navy engineers as they strolled onto his ship, cracking jokes about his broken-down engines. "And you don't fix a burned-out plasma engine with duct tape and chewing gum. You need a new containment field. I would be 16 days at the naval yards while Dorr set off without me. A hunk of rock 12 million miles from anything. My crew was thrilled, let me tell you."
"Wait, is this the same base where you fought the Hroom raiding party?"
Drake allowed a smile.
"As a matter of fact, yes."
"I've heard that part."
"I was waiting to see if the Admiralty would court-martial me, or merely toss my captain's bars in the trash,
when three sloops of war attacked the naval outpost. I held them off for 64 hours, while I waited for Dor to relieve me.
And that's why you didn't lose your commission, I suppose.
You feel like a goat now, Tolvan, he told her. But take care of business on Hartbasa, and you'll return feeling 10 feet tall. They'll build a statue to you back home some day.
Ha, even on Auckland they've got bigger celebrities than that.
Who, the annual winners of the local sheepdog trials? Drake said. He and Tolvern were both from the same sleepy rock way out on the end of the Zealand Islands. Or maybe that guy who built his entire home out of seashells. Remember him?
Thanks, Captain, she said.
For what?
For making me feel better.
It's always a good idea to pump someone up before you send her to her near certain death. He said this with a smile in his voice, but perhaps it was a little too close to the truth because her expression turned serious again. They spent a little bit of time looking at the mercenary ships on hire, mostly pirates, obviously, although in a time of war, that designation was fluid. Malthorn had hired a few privateers himself to harass shipping out of Saxony, but Drake had an easier time finding ships. Malthorn had ordered the atomic bombardment of San Pablo's eastern continent, destroying the Froom cities on that side of the planet in order to stir up war against the Empire. Even on the human side, that gesture had been taken poorly. There were several small schooners and two frigates, plus several ships that were harder to define. New Dutch and Ladino craft stripped down and cobbled together from so many pieces that Drake could only categorize them as warships, salvagers, and armed galleons. Not to mention a few that he considered so underarmed and poorly armored that it was pointless to hire them at all. Tiny 3 or 4 men craft that had to be hauled through jump points, but then could scurry around asteroid belts, staying out of the way of powerful enemies. Unless Isabel Vargas had a darn good reason, he'd tell her to cut them loose. The sum total was unimpressive. Drake thought Blackbeard and Vigilant could handle the lot. Certainly they'd be no match for Malthorn's heavy cruisers, corvettes, and destroyers, let alone Dreadnought. But if you threw in Vargas's outlaw, plus the always reliable pussycat, he supposed they would serve their purpose.
"I wish we had Orient Tiger," Tolvern said, after they'd chatted briefly with one of the schooner captains. "Katarina's ship is better than any of these, and I'll wager she's 10 times the commander, too."
"Katarina Vargas only looks out for herself," he said. "So put that idea out of your head."
"Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, if there's a way to put out the word, if we can lure her back, she's worth the money. I'd even take that scary mate of hers with the Gatling gun for an arm."
By now they'd taken a tour around the tarmac and visually inspected the mercenary armada. The shuttle was waiting to haul them back into orbit, where the fleet was finishing taking on supplies in preparation for a quick departure, but Tolvern wanted to take